Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Aside from putting nearly a million people out of work and curtailing government services, the recent government shutdown closed attractions like the Smithsonian in Washington and the National Zoo. And while you could see the Washington Monument from the outside, you couldn't climb to the top. The building was closed. The national parks, however, were not closed. Visitors' centers may not have been staffed. Maintenance ceased. Full-service restrooms were closed. But the parks themselves were wide open, with staffing reduced to about 20% of normal levels. Some leaders of the National Park Service have compared this to a situation, or compared this situation to opening the Smithsonian Museums with one guard at the door. They were right to be concerned. The result of leaving parks open led to some of them being damaged and vandalized, including the Outer Banks at Cape Hatteras National Seashore. In other parks, trees were cut down by unsupervised visitors, trash piled up, as did human waste, and at least seven people died. The vandalism, poaching, and damage in the parks will add to the $11 billion backlog of parks maintenance that needs to be done, just as hiring is about to begin for the high-traffic parks experience in the warmer months. So joining us to talk about all of this and more is Phil Francis. He is the chair of the Coalition to Protect America's National Parks, and Carolyn Ward is sitting right next to him. She is the CEO of the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation, and both join us from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Also with us is Kurt Repinchek. He's the editor and founder of the National Parks Traveler. That's a website and magazine which describes itself as the world's top-rated editorially independent nonprofit media organization dedicated to covering national parks and protected areas on a daily basis. And I went to the website yesterday. I would say that is not a boast in vain. I would say that's accurate. Kurt, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning. He's in Park City, Utah. You can join our conversation, too, wherever you are. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Before we talk about what we're going to talk about this morning, Phil, I have to ask a question about why, given the fact that we have the National Park Service, why we need a coalition to protect America's national parks. Isn't that the job of Congress and the Park Service?
Well, it is. But it's also the responsibility of all of us owners. We all visit the national parks, it seems. About 330 million people visited last year alone. And Congress pays more attention to the general public than anyone else. And so we are able to, as a coalition, say what's on our mind. We're not restricted. We don't have to live according to talking points. And their coalition is made up primarily of retired National Park Service employees. For example, I spent 41 years in the National Park Service. And so we call ourselves the voices of experience. So we're able to say things and advocate for the mission of the Park Service and advocate for the parks and its employees, whereas park employees oftentimes aren't allowed to even comment on issues.
So this is a passion for you because of your 41 years with the Park Service, and I imagine your initial interest in the parks, which led you to that job, but you're unleashed.
I'm unleashed, yes. Okay. I have been leashed before.
Or I should say unmuzzled.
That's correct.
Carolyn Ward, you're with the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation, and we've talked, I believe, to other people from the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation over the years. The Blue Ridge Parkway, part of the National Park Service. Why do we need a foundation?
Well, the Blue Ridge Parkway, for example, has 16 million visitors. That's more visitors than Yellowstone, Yosemite, and the Grand Canyon combined.
Is that because they're passing through on the road?
Well, it has a lot to do with the population centers that surround the Blue Ridge Parkway and the fact that it connects two major national parks, Shenandoah National Park to Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Okay. So when you think about an East Coast experience, it provides an extraordinary natural resource and cultural experience for visitors. But that visiting population of 16 million people in this park receives a fraction of the budget of any one of those other national parks. And that's why you need a foundation like us. We try to help bridge that gap in funding between what the park gets and what it actually needs to operate.
Why doesn't it get enough to operate?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. I think the total budget for the National Park Service is a fraction of 1% of our total budget for the United States. And so I think that our national parks are our great cathedrals and deserve to have more funding. They were supposed to be designed to be managed in perpetuity, and yet they receive an annual operating budget that often doesn't cover the operating costs, and that's what has resulted in that backlog maintenance that you mentioned earlier.
Is that because of a change in political, and anybody can answer this question, but is that lack of funding due to a change in political point of view since the establishment of these parks, or is simply because we have more people at more departments asking for money and not enough money coming in?
Well, this is Phil, and I was a superintendent at the Blue Ridge Parkway as well as the Great Smokies, and when I arrived at both parks, I noticed that our budgets were comparably smaller than some of the bigger parks out west, the Yellowstones and the Yosemite. For example, I think the Blue Ridge Parkway budget's probably about one-third that of Yellowstone, even though Yellowstone's visitation is 4 million, the Blue Ridge Parkway visitation's about 16 million. But the way the budget works, the budget has remained essentially flat for many years. If you go back to 2010, we had a pretty good year. But in the years that followed, the budgets have remained flat. The expenses have gone up faster than the income, which is too bad because the investment in their national park system is important economically for our country. For the $2.5 billion that we spend each and every year to run off 417 national park units, the economic output is about $39 billion. I keep looking for an investment like that for myself, but I haven't found one yet. And it's important. It generates thousands and thousands of jobs for America, and provides a means for our visiting public to learn about our country's history and visit our most special places. So budgets just haven't kept up. And one of the problems, if I can continue real quickly, is the interest on the national debt is now about the same as it is for the military, for the budget of the military. And so the non-defense discretionary agencies, which represent about 13% of the total federal budget, is being constantly squeezed as the interest on the national debt continues to rise. So we have a real problem, and it's going to be a very difficult thing to resolve. That's why volunteers and friends groups are so important.
So all three of you are here pretty much to talk about why the parks stayed open during this recent government shutdown and what the impact of that is in the short and the long term. We invited some folks on from the National Park Service, but they were unable to join us because this is their second day back at work and they have a little work to do, evidently, so they couldn't provide anybody. So I hope that one of you can answer this question, maybe Kurt. Why were the national parks kept open during this shutdown, given the fact that in previous shutdowns they were closed?
I think it all goes back to politics. I mean, we're a very political nation, and the National Park Service and National Park System, unfortunately, is a political football of sorts. Back in 2013, when the government shut down for 13 days, I think it was, the Obama administration kept the parks closed, and they viewed it as a stewardship decision because you couldn't manage all the landscape of the parks and all the visitors with the skeleton Park Service staff. And I think we've just seen that with the latest shutdown. And back in 2013, there was a lot of outrage by Republican members of Congress that the parks were closed. And so I think with the Republican administration in, they wanted to keep the parks open and show that it could succeed.
But the Smithsonian and monuments around the D.C. area were closed. Aren't they run by the National Park Service?
Not the Smithsonian.
Not the Smithsonian. Why would that not be remained open? It seems if it's political, if there's any truth to what some people say, that the Trump administration wanted to keep the parks open to minimize any political fallout during this shutdown, if that's true, why wouldn't they also keep the Smithsonian open, for crying out loud?
Well, there's a lot more national parks across the country than there are Smithsonians across the country, and so there's a larger fan base, if you will, for the national parks than there is for the Smithsonian.
And evidently, there was a memo that went out in January of, last year, dictating that national parks remain open during any government shutdown. Was this planned ahead of time? If that's true, why last January? Just a policy decision?
Well, there was a shutdown last January of several days.
So that remained in effect, that order?
I'm sorry?
So that order remained in effect for this one?
And it was altered, too. Okay. One of the key alterations was there's recreation fees that park visitors pay usually to enter the national park system where there are fees charged by parks. Mm-hmm. That money goes into what's called a Federal Lands Recreation Enhancement Act fund, and those dollars are supposed to be dedicated towards improving or enhancing the visitor experience, whether it's better interpretation or improving trails or whatnot. And late in this game, during the shutdown, the Interior Department changed that to allow the use of those dollars to be spent on cleaning restrooms and picking up trash. And one of the casualties, and unfortunately the shutdown ended soon thereafter that decision was made, but one of the casualties, 55% of those funds are supposed to be dedicated towards addressing the $11.6 billion maintenance backlog. And so it'll be interesting to see how much of that money was spent and what is left to go towards advancing visitor services or to go towards maintenance projects.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on in the program. People who focused on the actual government employees being out of work for so long probably think if the parks were open, that's a good thing, or they didn't think about it at all. And complaining about the parks being open may come as a surprise to some people, may even sound alarmist, because Diane Regas, who is the president of the Trust for Public Land, said, "Never before have I seen the federal government tempt fate in national parks in the way we are today. It's not about what has happened already. It's about what could happen if you don't have the appropriate staffing." Carolyn, are you on the same page? Is she overreacting to what happened?
No, I don't think so. I think that our national parks already operate at a reduced staffing level at the Blue Ridge Parkway, for example. I think about 34% of the staff positions are vacant and cannot be filled because there's not a budget. And so you ladle on top of that getting rid of the majority of the staff and just having law enforcement and essential personnel working. And then you keep the gates open and you keep the park open with 16 million potential visitors that could come. I think you're asking for potential damage.
And you are a former superintendent for the Blue Ridge Parkway, Phil, and for the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. You called on Congress during the government shutdown to close the parks for everyone's safety. Did you get a response?
No, I didn't. I did not. It's too bad. You know, the first responsibility of the National Park Service is to protect and preserve the resources and leave them unimpaired for future generations.
Right. Phil Francis, we'll have to come back, and I'll let you jump in, Kurt, when we come back from the break. We have to take a break. That's Kurt Repinshek, who wants to get in with the National Parks Traveler. Phil Francis is here, Coalition to Protect America's National Parks, and Carolyn Ward, the CEO of the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're joined by Phil Francis, chair of the Coalition to Protect America's National Parks, and Carolyn Ward, the CEO of the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation, sitting at Blue Ridge Public Radio this morning to talk about the impact of the decision to keep the parks open during the recent government shutdown. Kurt Repinchek is also with us. He's the editor and founder and a reporter for the National Parks Traveler magazine and website. And you wanted to jump in here, Kurt, just before the break. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I think the decision to keep the parks open this time around during the shutdown represented a great disrespect, not just for the employees of the National Park Service who were, 80% of them were cast out of work and they may get paid, they may not get paid back, but also to the entire park system itself and the parks movement that the United States launched back in 1872 when Yellowstone was established as the world's first national park. I mean, the National Park Service Organic Act clearly spells out that the preservation of these incredible places is foremost the responsibility of the National Park Service. And I think not just the Trump administration, but I think the Congress has lost sight of that. And really, what happened the past month shouldn't have happened. The parks should have been closed and protect those precious resources for future generations to enjoy.
And you reported in your publication that we can expect more than a few Freedom of Information Act requests to be filed concerning not just the decision-making regarding keeping the parks open, but what damage occurred. You think we'll have to resort to Freedom of Information Act requests to get that information?
I'd like to think not, but My experience has shown me that administrations, whether it's a Democratic administration or a Republican administration, do not like to talk about negatives. And that was one reason why, after we reported about the damage at Joshua Tree, that the superintendent was quickly told not to grant any more interviews. The Interior Department only wanted to hear good news, such as we're opening the parks and we're going to be able to clean up the garbage. Right. They didn't want you to hear about the donuts being driven around in Death Valley National Park or trees being chopped down in Joshua Tree.
Yeah, you called that a blackout on news. And I was going to ask you, but you've already answered the question, but I was going to ask you if it could have been that they were at a 20% staffing level, and so they didn't have the personnel to get that news out, but you're saying that it was propaganda. Or at least spin.
Definitely spin. I mean, it was interesting that even superintendents of the national parks were furloughed. Are superintendents not the most essential personnel to be out there in the national parks, regardless of whether the government's functioning or not? It was interesting that the parks would put out tweets and put out Facebook announcements about we're not monitoring these social media channels, and so, good luck out there. And so with a perfect example is the Joshua Tree situation where they sent out a press release about undescribed vandalism that occurred in the park. And so I had called up the superintendent to find out what that vandalism was, and fortunately I was able to reach the superintendent. He explained it to me. Other parks would send out press releases, and you couldn't call anybody. You'd place a phone call and you get a recording that we're out of office until after the furlough is over.
Yeah,
very strange way to manage.
So we know about in Joshua Tree National Park that people cut down Joshua trees, that they did wheelies with their off-road vehicles in the desert. What other reports of damage or vandalism have we heard about in parks around the country, Kurt?
There was a passing mention yesterday I saw from Shenandoah about visitors behaving in some way that they shouldn't have, and I've got a request into the park to find out what exactly happened. In upstate New York, I believe at Saratoga National Historic Site, I think there was a fire in the visitor center, and details have yet to come out whether that was an act of vandalism or just bad wiring. There were some incidents, I think Phil and Carolyn could probably explain them better, at the Outer Banks at Cape Hatteras National Seashore with excrement and other vandalism.
Yeah, we heard about the vandalism near the lighthouse, Phil and Carolyn. What else do we know about what went on down there?
I'm not really sure, but I think one of the real challenges on the Outer Banks is there are areas that driving is prohibited, and those areas are marked off. By opening the parks without adequate staff, that allows people to drive in areas they shouldn't drive. And so I'm not sure. I haven't really seen a list. There hasn't been a lot of information shared. In fact, most of the information that I've been able to learn is from the press.
Anything in your neck of the woods, up near the Great Smokies or the Blue Ridge Parkway?
Yeah. You know, before the shutdown occurred, we had some high winds, we had snowfalls, we had record amounts of rain this year. We have thousands of trees that have fallen down across the trails and roads and the road corridors. It's going to take a long time to clear those roads and trails and
but,
to make
But that wasn't due to the shutdown.
That was not due to the shutdown. But what is due to the shutdown is the fact that we didn't have staff to respond to those downed trees back when those trees fell. And so now we've got an accumulated problem with so much occurring without any attention being paid to that issue in a timely way. So not only now, and this is really an important point, is do we have to address these things that have occurred during the shutdown, but they also have to be thinking about how are we going to open the parks in time in the spring and summer? Will we have enough staff? Something that often is forgotten is that our personnel staff was on furlough. And normally our personnel staff would be putting together a list of seasonal employees that our supervisors can hire and bring on later in the year. All of that has been postponed, and it's going to have impacts to the visitor, certainly for some time to come.
I want to get back to Joshua Tree for just a second, because I've been out there, and it's magnificent. But I keep reading reports of people doing wheelies in the desert, and from a point of complete ignorance, Kurt, that doesn't sound so bad to me. What's wrong with that?
Well, in places like Joshua Tree and Death Valley National Park, you get off-road into areas where you shouldn't be driving, and the soils, the desert soils, are what's called cryptobiotic soils. And basically, there's a living organism on the upper surface of that soil, and it takes 200, 250 years for that cryptobiotic soil to establish itself and grow. And when you take a 1,000-pound vehicle and drive it over, you can imagine the compression that's going on, and it's not going to come back tomorrow.
So what is, for those of you who don't know, including me, what is cryptobiotic soil? What does it do? What is it?
it's an organism that basically holds the desert together it's a living part of the desert.
Wow.
The soils.
So driving, doing wheelies is not only stupid, it's irresponsible.
Even walking in some areas
really
damages the soils, yeah.
Okay. There are more than 19 million visitors to our national parks, I believe, every year. It's clear that even at full staffing, park rangers can't supervise all of those people. So why would there be that much of an incremental increase in damage or vandalism by people visiting the parks when they're understaffed, as they were during the shutdown? Nobody?
Well, this is Phil, yeah. Actually, we have 331 million visitors
okay,
a year.
Okay, well, excuse me. I misread that quote, that stat.
And while it is a small percentage during the shutdown period, you know, when the doors are open and no one's at home, it provides opportunities to go places that would be restricted and we would have staff to prevent entrance in those areas. And so just like the quote that you cited, it's like opening the doors of the Smithsonian and saying, right, the restrooms are open, here, have at it.
Right. So would you say then that the vandalism and the damage that was done in the last month to these parks was done by people who are normally attracted to parks or by people who just saw this as an opportunity to go in and have their way with them? Because normally they would be told, don't do that or step away from that or don't go in that. That's a restricted area. Don't go. Which subset of people are we talking about?
Well, I would say that people who visit the national parks in large part, high percentage, really respect the resources, and they are very, very, very good visitors. It's a very small percentage of people who don't respect the parks and look for open and free access and maybe have ill intent. So I have to think that, you know, it was that latter category who saw an opportunity and took advantage of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of research out there that shows about 2 to 4% of the visitors that come to national parks have sort of malicious intent. And when you have rangers on site and Park Service personnel, they can try to help manage that 2 to 4%.
Who are those people? This has been going on forever, I would suppose. But who are these people? Because it seems to me that most people that go to parks go there because they appreciate what the parks are all about. They appreciate being around nature. They like the beauty of it all, the peace and tranquility of it all. They want to see things that they don't get to see in their normal lives. And so they want to preserve that. Who are these people that want to come there with malicious intent? Are they just young people or who are not mature? Who are they?
There's a research study that we did in Petrified Forest National Park looking at that depreciative behavior and people that would come in and steal petrified wood that's a finite resource that cannot be replaced in our lifetime, certainly. And a lot of the people that performed that behavior did it from a lack of knowledge, did it because they believe they pay their taxes and they own that resource and they can do anything they want with it and don't want to be managed or controlled. A lot of the behavior was ill-informed. They were unsure about the ramifications of what they had done. And so there's a lot that goes into why someone does a particular behavior. Often they don't understand the consequences.
And you've said, Carolyn, that it's difficult to assess the damage at this stage in parks around the country and to know what lasting repercussions there will be from whatever damage did occur. But can you extrapolate from past experience?
Well, one of the things, as Phil mentioned earlier, for example, on the parkway, they can't even access a lot of the sites yet to even determine the damage. One of the concerns that we have is that lasting damage that will occur that we're not even beginning to measure yet. For example, you have a fleet of vehicles that the Park Service owns and manages and operates, and they haven't been started for 35 days. And think about your car sitting out in the driveway and winds and temperatures below zero, and you don't start it for 30-some days. You're going to have some impacts to that. And so you think about visitor centers and water systems and pipes, and there's a lot of damage beyond what you can visibly see of the thousands of trees down that Phil mentioned earlier. And I think it's going to take a considerable amount of time before they can begin to even determine that. And then you ladle on top of that the 30 days that were missed of critical planning, hiring, thinking about the next season and getting things open and operating. You've already put yourself considerably behind, and now you're dealing with a lot of maintenance and deferred issues over that time period as well. It's a cumulative impact.
Despite the fact that it may be difficult to assess whatever damage may have occurred, Kurt, your publication, The National Parks Traveler, says that, quote, one sign that damage is occurring, either indirectly or intentionally, was news the other day that the National Park Foundation has set up the Parks Restoration Fund to help repair parks as quickly as possible once the government reopens. Is this something that is unique to this shutdown, or could this be standard operating procedure?
You know, it struck me as this is unique. I don't recall them doing the same thing back in 2013. And, you know, maybe it was just a fundraising gambit. I did ask them if they had background knowledge of damage that was occurring out there, and they told me no. But to launch a fundraising campaign of that extent to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, to repair unspecified damage is I'm a skeptic by nature of my profession, and so you question everything. So you know, hopefully there's not that much damage out there, and as Phil and Carolyn have alluded to, it's a very minute segment of the park going public that feels necessary to damage or to you know, go off-road in these places. And so hopefully there won't be that much damage.
So, Phil, there were reports from various parks about trash cans spilling over because nobody was there to empty them. Worse, human waste was found outdoors. Certainly that was the case down at Cape Hatteras National Seashore and other parks around the country. Is that because the bathrooms were closed? And is this just a more distasteful temporary problem, or does this have lasting impact?
Complicated question, actually. Sounds like a simple one, but you know, when the government shuts down, employees are put into two categories: essential and non-essential. And non-essential includes maintenance employees who might be present to keep those bathrooms clean and sanitary, and to operate wastewater treatment plants, and so forth. I think to go back to a previous part of our discussion today, one of the things that park rangers provide in visitor centers is a place for people to report wrongdoing. It's a place where people can go if there's an emergency, a medical emergency. And I have a problem with this terminology of calling these people who are critically important to the operation of our national parks as non-essential. They are essential. They're very, very important, and they're part of a puzzle that provides the kind of service and protection of our resources that people have come to expect. So to answer your question about long-term impacts, when people go to visitor centers and they find the restrooms closed, they're going to go anyway, let me assure you, and I could take you to places that you probably wouldn't want to go to again as a consequence of that. And it takes a long time for those areas to recover. They do.
And does that kind of activity pose danger to the wildlife?
I'm not so sure about that. I think the wildlife probably tend to stay away as much as we do. But it's certainly a public health risk. It is something that should not be occurring. And that's one of the advantages of closing a park area. We don't have the same level of problem when the park is closed.
Right. When you don't have visitors centers open and you don't have park personnel who understand the park and know the park and know what goes on in the park, it seems to me that you can't educate or warn people about dangers in a park. And you also don't tell them about wildlife and interaction with wildlife. When we come back, I want to talk about that because there have been reports of people becoming just a little too friendly in these parks, with these parks remaining open with no supervision, with wildlife, and that has an impact. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the state of the national parks and what may or may not have occurred in them during the government shutdown, during which the parks remained open but were severely understaffed at about the 20% level. Phil Francis joins us from Blue Ridge Public Radio, where he is the chair of the Coalition to Protect America's National Parks. Carolyn Ward is sitting right next to him. She's the CEO of the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation. And joining us from Park City, Utah, Kurt Rapinchek, editor, founder of the National Parks Traveler. There were reports during this shutdown of people poaching in the national parks, and there have been reports for years about people becoming too friendly with wildlife. There's a photograph that I saw just the other day of an elk who had become, I guess, desensitized to human beings because human beings had tried to feed it, etc., and that posed a danger not only to the elk, who was then put down, but also to human beings, because elk are dangerous animals. How much of this went on during the recent shutdown, Kurt?
I don't think as much as you might think.
Good.
There were poaching reports, but Park Service tells me that those were actually legal kills done outside the parks, and in one case, three deer, for some reason, the hunter dropped them in the national park. I guess he didn't want to take them home and clean them. But the poaching, it wasn't poaching. It was legal kills done outside the national park system. A great concern was raised in Yosemite, where before the Floria funds were used to bring in park staff to clean up the mess, you had overflowing trash bins, and the same thing down at Big Bend National Park. And the problem with that is that we have spent decades teaching the public to clean up after themselves, to prevent wildlife from getting human foods and getting used to the, right. the taste of human foods. And John Jarvis, the former Park Service director, basically told me, you know, we threw all that learning away because we had all this garbage pile up and the wildlife were getting it. At Sequoia National Park, they actually closed the park in part because of the great amounts of garbage and the wildlife that were attracted to it and that were strewing it around. And so that was one key problem with the wildlife, was the availability of human trash that they were able to.
So when they get a taste for human food, does that not go away over time? In other words, does that become a danger to park visitors who may be camping because they associate that food with humans, so they come too close to you to explore the possibilities of food being available?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is case after case every summer, it seems, whether it's Grand Teton or Glacier or Yosemite, where a black bear gets a little bit too curious looking for what's inside that picnic basket.
So your organization, Carolyn, the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation, donated money to reopen visitors' centers along the Blue Ridge Parkway for 3 weekends, beginning last weekend, which was kind of late, but because the shutdown is over now, but nonetheless, you did it. Why open visitors' centers if we assume that visitors might be damaging the parks in some way?
Well, it's a very difficult question. It seems sort of simple on the surface. As Phil said, if you have visitor centers open, then you can help protect the resource and you can help provide that critical information to visitors. And it sort of leads into something you talked about earlier with the National Park Foundation about whether or not we should be doing that kind of thing as groups like us, raising money to build a reserve fund and open visitor centers. It's a political and a philosophical question. We waited because we believe that replacing government funds that ought to be there to support our national parks with private funds is a very slippery slope. Groups like us are supposed to be doing added value projects, things that wouldn't be covered by a normal operating budget, that add value to the visitor experience or help protect the resource. And when we're relegated to keeping visitor centers open, which should be done by the federal government, we're not able to do those other projects. And we also send a message that the federal funds are not important and that our parks are not important. And they are. And so we waited to take that action because we were concerned about the message that that would send right. to Congress and to legislators.
Part of the Blue Ridge Parkway had been closed because of previous storms and in the fall, and I think they had remained closed. You correct me if I'm wrong, but what impact, if that is the case, what impact has the shutdown had on the work that needed to be done to get those areas reopened?
Well, I think as Phil mentioned earlier, it was sort of a triple whammy. There was a massive storm that happened, an ice storm that happened prior to the shutdown, that brought a lot of trees down across the motor road, and staff would have been out there cleaning that up and getting that fixed. And then we had an ice storm after the shutdown, and we had 60-mile-an-hour winds, 100-mile-an-hour winds clocked up at Grandfather Mountain along the parkway that I'm sure brought a lot of trees down. So now you've got this sort of accumulated damage that's going to take far longer yeah. to clean up than if we had done it each time that it occurred.
So parks evidently during this shutdown were required to dig into the money they collect from entrance fees. Not all parks collect entrance fees. Many of them do. And those entrance fees, if I understand this correctly, they get to keep 80% of what they collect at the gate, but the other 20% is made available for projects in national parks around the country. So what was the impact of using the funds that they collect at the gate during the shutdown on operating expenses during the shutdown? Phil?
Well, those projects had been identified by parks that would be funded using those funds. and now those funds have been used for another purpose. We don't know yet. We haven't seen the final figures as to how much of those funds have been spent. But it means that those projects that would have been taken care of with those funds are now gone. Mm. And so it just adds more to the $11.8 billion backlog. And you know, and if you look at the that number, $11.8 billion, the National Park Service total budget is about $3.2 billion. And of that $3.2 billion, $2.5 of that operates the parks.
I have to ask. You know, I thought the number was $11.6 billion. You're saying it's $11.8 billion. And this is just this is not just peculiar to the national parks. We have infrastructure shortfalls all over this country. Yes. That the federal government is supposed to be funding. And I have to ask, is this underfunding or simply bad management?
Underfunding, clearly. We have very dedicated employees who have squeezed everything they can out of each and every dollar that is spent on these parks. We have looked at alternative ways of accomplishing those projects. We contract out a lot of those projects. We do some of their projects in-house by our dedicated employees. But it, as Carolyn mentioned before, it's less than 1/16 or 1/15 of 1% of the federal budget is spent in the national parks. In 1981, it was 1/8 of 1%. We're losing ground, and the pressure that is on our non-defense discretionary agencies, such as the National Institute for Health, Center for Disease Control, National Park Service, and so forth, you know, that pressure continues to build. And we've got to find a solution to that.
This backlog is twice what the president is asking for his wall. When you hear him ask for the $5 billion-plus dollars for his wall, what do you think?
Well, that is a tough one. You know, the way I've always looked at projects or needs is what needs to be accomplished and what is the best way of doing it? Is it a wall? Are other alternatives available that might be used? How does this stack up with regard to the other deficiencies in our national budget? Someone at a higher grade level than me would have to take a look at the total federal backlog and decide which of the projects are the most important.
So Carol,
there are a lot of important ones.
Carol, on the Blue Ridge Parkway is said to have one of the highest maintenance backlogs in the entire national park system. It's, I think, $462 million is the last figure that I saw there. And the Great Smokies Fill has a backlog of about $215 million. Where is most of the need? What are the most critical things that money should be or could be used for?
Well, half of it is really for road maintenance. And if you look at the Blue Ridge Parkway, 469 miles of motor road.
Right.
And the Great Smoky Mountains has a couple hundred miles of roadway, too. So about half of that are road projects. And so that funding comes from a little separate pot of money. Federal Highway Administration helps provide those funds through a special account. So we just need support from our public, and they need to let their members of Congress know this is important.
Carolyn said during the shutdown, you said that you heard from ordinary people who were frustrated by how the parks were being affected by the shutdown, and he just said the parks need the support of the public. What can ordinary people do, Carolyn?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons groups like us exist and exist across the whole country, because we do see that need, and the parks do belong to us. It's our national parks. We're the owners of it, and the National Park Service staff are the caretakers that we entrust to help take care of that place for our kids and our grandkids. And I think one of the biggest things that folks can do is try to help support their park, whether it's volunteering or donating. We at the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation have given over $14 million to the Blue Ridge Parkway to help do those projects that otherwise could not be funded. And we do it for lots of reasons, to help protect the resource and provide a better visitor experience, and for the economy of all these little mountain communities. The Blue Ridge Parkway brings over $1 billion of economic support to these mountain communities and supports over 15,000 jobs. And so for us, it's an investment in the future. Our national parks were given to us as a legacy from those that came before us, and it is our responsibility to leave that legacy for our kids. And so everything that you do, whether it's calling a congressman, volunteering, or helping give money back to help us do some of those projects is essential.
And the national parks do pump money into local economies around the country. We intended to have somebody on from the Cape Hatteras National Seashore. I'm sure they would have echoed those comments, but they couldn't join us either. Kurt, nationally, you report that the park system has ailing wastewater treatment facilities, rotting buildings, crumbling parking lots, dams and levees in serious condition, shabby employee housing, and antiquated communications systems. This sounds like this has been going on because of overuse of the parks, underfunding of the parks, neglect, or a combination of all of those things, but for a long time. How would you describe it?
It has been going on for a long time. When George W. Bush was running for president back in 2000, I think, the backlog at that time was roughly $5 billion, and he said that he would wipe it out in his first 6 years, I think, already banking on two terms in office. And obviously he didn't get it done, and I think it goes back on Congress. And
Well, you've said Congress has turned its eyes away from this backlog.
You know, members of Congress love to have a national park in their district. It's a big tourism thing. It's big economic. It brings attention to their district. When it comes around to paying the bills, they have shown time and time again that they do not want to do that. And just this last Congress, there was a bipartisan effort in the House and a bipartisan effort in the Senate to pass legislation to provide roughly $6.5 billion over 5 years to wipe out half of the backlog. And unfortunately, both those bills died at the end of the 115th Congress in December, and now they're going to have to start back at square one, and we're waiting to see if that legislation is reintroduced, and I'm sure it will be. But, you know, it's obvious that there needs to be a great amount of pressure exerted on Congress because some members do not want to spend a dime on anything other than the military.
These parks were positioned from the very beginning as a way to preserve the natural beauty of the continent, and they have become, over time, in many people's minds, a national treasure. Does there need to be some sort of campaign to reintroduce the national parks and that attitude about them to the American public, or is it there already and just being ignored by our lawmakers? I'm not sure who to ask that question of.
Well, I'm not sure we need another campaign. I mean, the campaign to reintroduce America to the national parks during the Park Service Centennial in 2016 was wildly successful. Mm-hmm. I think the campaign we need is educating the park-going public on how to behave in national parks.
Okay. And Phil and Carolyn, they say, you know, the government's open now, and people have gone back to work, and the park rangers are back. But even though the parks were open during the shutdown, should visitors be going right now? Are they just going to get in the way of all the work that needs to be done that wasn't done for the past 34 days?
Well, I think it's going to be different depending on the park. I noticed this morning in the newspaper that Carl Sandburg home is still closed because of the extent of the damage. I don't know what's happened at Guilford Courthouse or Morris Creek, the other two units in North Carolina, but the public needs to be patient. They need to be aware, find out, go to the visitor center, see what the state of things are, and to assist the parks and understand that these men and women who care so much about the parks that they would give their entire lives to preserving and protecting them, providing service to the public, you know, are doing the best they can with limited resources.
Any final words, Carolyn? You have about 10 seconds.
No, I would just encourage everybody to be patient. It's been a long 35 days, and all the help and support they can give is much appreciated.
Carolyn Ward is the CEO of the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation. Phil Francis is the chair of the Coalition to Protect America's National Parks and a former employee of the National Park Service. And Kurt Rapinchek is editor, founder, and reporter for the National Parks Traveler magazine and website. Thank you all for the hour.
No, thank you.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.